Here we go then, part four of Reclaiming the Divine Feminine. And today we're going to look at the women in the Bible who kind of escaped the purge, if you like, that are still there and demonstrating the Divine Feminine. These are stories mostly from before the ending of the First Temple, and some of them are before the creation of the First Temple, which means that in those days it was not necessarily a monotheistic faith. Other aspects were allowed in, and we've already spoken about the idea of the lady, the Ashrata, the woman, the goddess, the mother of Yahweh, the mother of the king. And as we look at this slide, number two on the PowerPoint, we'll be looking today at Deborah and Yael and at Esther. No, not at Esther. We're looking at Esther next week, and at Hannah. And these are women who are at the soul level of the Tree of Life. Now, I think I'm the only person who's ever put the women of the Bible onto the Tree of Life. But the extraordinary thing about them is that chronologically, they demonstrate how the human soul develops. We have Eve and Lilith right up at the very top in the spiritual world, because neither of them existed in the physical world. Mystics know that Eden was not the physical world, it was the psychological world, it was the preparation world. And once humanity came out of Eden, they put on coats of skin, which meant they became physically incarnate. Before then, they hadn't been. But the other women, from Sarah upwards, start at the bottom of the Tree of Life, because Sarah, Rebecca, Leah and Rachel and Zilpah, Bilhah and Hagar, who are all in the stories of the patriarchs and the matriarchs, all are defined by tribe. All those women are utterly defined by their husbands and their children. They have very little say in anything. And what decisions they make are, well, the Buddhists would call them unskillful. They're very much revered by the Jewish faith, which is ironic because, in fact, Ruth, Deborah, Esther, and Hannah are absolutely soul companions. They are women who work with the divine, and they work with the divine feminine, as we're going to see. Dinah and Rahab are in the side triads of the Tree of Life, and Rahab, who was the acknowledged prostitute who let the Israelites into the city of Jericho, so they were able to sack it, is in the triad of addictive pleasure, which would be appropriate, and Dinah is in the triad of pain and grief and guilt. Dinah was Leah's daughter, and she was, we believe, raped by a rival chieftain's son. Apparently he loved her and wanted to marry her, and Jacob's sons in theory agreed with that, but then went into the city and killed all the men in there, and Dinah was left to live her life as a ruined woman in the tribe of Israel. So those are not good stories until we get up to Ruth. Once we get to Ruth, it's about a woman who steps out of the tribe. We won't be going into it particularly here. But she steps out of the tribe and is willing to be a refugee in a foreign land and to follow her heart. And that's important because she's the wake-up call in the stories of the women in the Bible to say that a woman can live the life that she wants to live. But Ruth, Deborah, Yael, Hannah and Esther were all before the Second Temple. Ruth was before the First Temple, as was Deborah and as was Hannah. Esther took place in the time of the Babylonian exile. So we'll be working with three people who represent the soul of humanity, not just the soul of women, but the divine feminine in the soul of humanity. And I've got a couple of pages here that you can look through later if you want to, just to remind you of the qualities of yin and yang, or the divine masculine or feminine. There are lots more than those, but these give you a good idea. And we're going to be looking very much at discernment, discipline, and the words no, which are the powerful yin tonight. And on the next slide, it's all the, well, not all of them, but most of the negative aspects of the yang and yin, just to remind you. So let's start off with a story that is actually fake news. And this is the story of Lilith. You may have heard of Lilith. She's mentioned once in the book of Isaiah. And actually, all he says is he refers to the screech owl, which is the Lilitu. And this is translated as Lilith. And Lilith is a story that was completely made up by people who had no mystical knowledge of the Bible at all. And as is so often the case, a made-up story, a lie, as we know, goes round the world in seconds, whereas the truth, it finds it really hard to get off any feet whatsoever. And the Lilith story was said to have been known at the time of the Babylonian exile, which makes sense because this was the time of the end of the first temple, the Babylonian invasion, when the Hebrews were taken off to Babylon and lived there, not quite as slaves, but certainly not as particularly prosperous people. And they needed a reason why this disaster had happened. And the idea was either the disaster had happened because they had ended the first temple, or the disaster had happened because they hadn't ended the first temple soon enough. And the people who believed the latter had to come up with a reason why any aspect of divine feminine was, in fact, demonic. Now, there was a man called Ben Sirach who lived in Babylon at this time. Nebuchadnezzar was the king who invaded Judea and took the Israelites into captivity. And the alphabet of Ben Sirach is how we have the story of Lilith fleshed out. We don't know how much of an oral tradition it was back there, but it was only written down between 700 and 1000 in the Common Era. So this is a medieval story. And I'm sure there was a legend beforehand, but I'm going to read you exactly what it says in the alphabet of Ben Sirach. It's quite a short piece. But what's interesting is that many scholars believe that the whole of this alphabet of Ben Sirach is supposed to be satire. It's not meant to be taken seriously at all, but it has been taken seriously, just in the same way that when St. Augustine came up with the theory of original sin, it was adopted, but it was a theory. And then when St. Anselm in the 13th century came up with the theory of penal substitutionary atonement, which is the idea that humanity had behaved so badly that God had to send his own son to kill his own son because we were so bad, that was taking original sin even further than Augustine had. But it was only a theory, but it just took off because we just like this negativity stuff so much, and we always have done. So, the alphabet of Ben Sirach about Lilith says that the young son of King Nebuchadnezzar, took ill. And he said to Ben Sirach, who was a well-known Jewish philosopher of the time, "Heal my son, and if you don't, I will kill you." And Ben Sirach immediately sat down and wrote an amulet with the holy name on it of the divine, and he inscribed on it the angels in charge of medicine by their names, forms, and images, by their wings, hands, and feet. And Nebuchadnezzar looked at the amulet and said, "Who are these?" And he replied, "The angels who are in charge of medicine, Senoi, Sansanoi, and Semelgloth. While God created Adam, who was alone, he said, 'It's not good for man to be alone.'" That's Genesis 2:18. "He created a woman from the earth, as he had created Adam himself, and called her Lilith. Adam and Lilith immediately began to fight. She said, 'I will not lie below you.' And he said, 'I will not lie beneath you, but only on top, for you are fit only to be in the bottom position, while I am to be the superior one.' Lilith responded, 'We are equal to each other inasmuch as we were both created from the earth.' But they would not listen to one another. When Lilith saw this, she pronounced the ineffable name and flew away into the air. Adam stood in prayer before his creator, saying, 'Sovereign of the universe, the woman you gave me has run away.' And at once the Holy One, blessed be he, sent these three angels to bring her back." Now I'm going to stop there for a minute and say why this is such fake news. Because in Genesis, it says quite clearly that the Elohim created humanity in their own image. Remember, Elohim is a plural noun. And this was male and female created the Elohim, them both. And people think that was a man and a woman because they're immediately going to physical reality. And this is one of the things we do in this rational world of ours. But this is a myth. It's a perennial truth. And this is referring to the world of Berea, the world of creation, before beings are formed. So every creature that's ever been created is first created in Berea before it moves down to the Yetzeratic world of form. And in Berea, all creatures were sexless or genderless or a meld of the two. It's only in Yetzirah that masculine and feminine happen. It's in Yetzirah that we get darkness and lightness, day and night. In Berea, it's all concept. So there wasn't a physical woman. There wasn't a physical first wife. There was one human being concept, male and female. And then when they moved down to Yetzirah, to the Garden of Eden, they became Adam and Eve. And it says that God took Eve from the side of Adam. It's not rib, it's side. It's usually translated as rib. So basically, this one being became two beings. So the theory of Lilith for a mystic is utter rubbish. However, it still can work out to be quite a useful story, because all good stories have a purpose and a place. So the Holy One said to Adam, if she agrees to come back, that is made good. If not, she must permit 100 of her children to die every day. And the angels left God and pursued Lilith, whom they overtook in the midst of the sea, in the mighty waters in which the Egyptians were destined to drown. They told her God's word, but she did not wish to return. The angels then said, we will drown you in this sea. She said, leave me. I was created only to cause sickness to infants. If the infant is male, I have dominion over him for 8 days after his birth, and if female, for 20 days. So you can see she's setting up very nicely here as a demoness. So we've got this whole legend coming out about the feisty woman refusing to lie under the man, refusing to submit to him, saying that she's equal. You can see why feminists have picked up on this story over the generations. When the angels heard Lilith's words, they insisted she go back, but she swore to them by the name of the living and eternal God. Whenever I see you or your names or your forms on an amulet, I will have no power over that infant. She also agreed to have 100 of her children die every day. Accordingly, every day 100 demons perish, and for the same reason we write the angels' names on the amulets of young children. When Lilith sees their names, she remembers her oath and the child recovers. So that's the legend of Lilith, and Orthodox Jewry still have those amulets which they place in bedrooms. And we all over the world also still live in the echo of that completely fake story, because the word Lilith is the root of lullaby. And a lullaby was originally what we sang to a child to keep it safe overnight, or so the legend goes. But Lilith is kind of useful in some ways, because if you notice, I put her higher up the tree of life. I put her up at the top in the area of Chochmah. If you look back at number two, slide number two, Lilith is with Adam at Chochmah. And that's appropriate, because I am at the top of the tree of life is the divine. So the first creation of Adam and Lilith in one being would be at Chochmah. So Lilith has to be there. And what's interesting about the story is that she knew the ineffable name of God. Lilith spoke the ineffable name of God and flew away. And Adam didn't know that name. So you can actually take this as an interesting story along the lines of each of the Sephiroth of the Tree of Life has to receive the life of the divine and then pass it on. And the method of passing it on is to bow, to lean over, to pass it further down this tree. So you can actually see that there is rhyme in this reason. If Lilith knew, was the firstborn, she knew the name of the divine, which Adam didn't, but she refused to pass that knowledge on. So we can use this fake news as an interesting story about, are we willing to receive from God? And that's a very powerful lesson for all of us, because many of us won't receive from God. And it requires a lot of discipline to do so. So the little story can be useful, but it's not actually the story for all the feminists that we think it is, because it's simply not true. And of course, we don't know that any of the Bible stories are literal, and we're not meant to take them literally. So if we make allegories and they work for us, then that's okay. So let's move on to a story that really embodies the divine feminine, totally embodies the Sephira of Gevurah. And Gevurah is on the left-hand side of the tree, and its judgment and its discernment and its discrimination and its strength and its might. And this story is in Judges 4:4. And it's pretty obvious that it's a pre-Second Temple story because Deborah is a judge of Israel. Before they had kings, they had judges. And the judges were the equivalent of a high priest or a high priestess. And Deborah is a named judge of Israel. And what is really interesting about Deborah is that she's described in the Bible as wife of Lapidoth. And that is shoved in later. It says Deborah, woman of Lapidoth. It can mean wife, absolutely. But the word Lapidoth means torch, lamp, or enlightenment. So what the Hebrew says is Deborah, woman of light. We don't know anything else about whether there was a Lapidoth, but Deborah, woman of light, is very powerful. It basically means this was the high priestess. It also says she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now, the word palm tree is Toma, and Moses Cordovero, who was the founder of the Toledano tradition of Kabbalah, which I follow and study and teach, wrote a whole book called Toma Devora, which is his interpretation of how the Sephirot flow down the tree. So he knew the value of this woman or this story. But the word Toma doesn't necessarily mean palm tree. It also means post. And as we studied last week, Ashrata, the divine feminine, had posts and trees around which the women wove scarves and placed offerings. So we have a woman who is a high priestess before the building of the first temple, whose place is below a tree. So here we have an extraordinary being. And slide number 7. Now, this is very, very controversial. I'm going to bring in the Jordanian lead books. The Jordanian lead books were found in Jordan. They were found there about 5 years ago in a cave. Now, the man who found them was a bit of a shyster, and you can't necessarily find his word, but I've actually held one of these books in my hand. They are definitely real. They've been carbon dated, and the outside, they're sealed. Every one of them is a lead book that is sealed. So if you want to carbon date on the inside, you have to open them. And they haven't been carbon dated on the inside, though some people have said that they have. Now, there's huge controversy about these. I choose to think that they're real, but it's absolutely up to you what you believe about them. But the carbon dating of the outside of them showed they are at least 1800 years old. And they're believed to be part of early Christianity's attempt to return to the first temple. Now, the lady who is leading the campaign to get them correctly carbon dated all the way through and is translating aspects of them is Dr. Margaret Barker, whom I mentioned last week. And it's perfectly fair to say she's a very controversial figure. She's a Methodist lay preacher and a scholar. She was given her doctorate by the Archbishop of Canterbury in honour of her work with the Divine Feminine. And she believes passionately in this work because she believes that returning us to the knowledge of the Divine Feminine is the ecology that we need to save this planet. And I'm 100% with her on that. Now, as Margaret writes in the lead book, this is in an email she sent to me because we were discussing it, because Deborah is also Gebura. And Gebura is the same root as Gevurah. Remember, the old Hebrew did not have the vowels in it. So G-B-R-H is Gevurah because V and B are exactly the same. Deborah in Hebrew days was pronounced Devorah. So Gebirah, as you can see on slide number 7 with an E, means great lady. And Deborah is Debirah. And it's the same letter. So Deborah is identified as the great lady, the queen, or the mother of Israel. And Gevurah is Gabora. As you can see on that slide, it just needs a couple of the little letters there are the vowels that have been put in. The other ones that are vowels, it's all very complex. There are some letters which aren't really viewed as vowels, so those word letters would have been there. But whatever angle or dips, whatever you call a diphthong or whatever, over them defines what that actual letter means. But there's no doubt in my mind that Deborah was associated with the divine feminine as a priestess. What's also interesting about these sealed lead books is the writing on them. Some of it's in Hebrew letters, some's in Greek letters, but most of it's in Paleo-Hebrew letters. And that's the script that was used before about 500 before the Common Era. And it's so called not because it's ancestral to the Hebrew alphabet, but because it was used to write the earliest form of the Hebrew language. That's a distinct, though subtle, difference. But if these are letters that were used before 500 BCE, then the strong implication is that they are around the time of the fall of the First Temple, or certainly soon afterwards. And it would appear from the coding on them that they are trying to hold on to the divine feminine. Quite a few of them have the menorah on it, and they have trees and branches on it, and the one in this picture has a bee on it. And that's significant for our story of Deborah, because the word Deborah, the name, means bee. And the image here is of a queen bee. And of course, we know full well that the queen bee has a matrilineal hive. The queen bee is the one that rules, and everybody else works towards the queen bee. So the fact that this is the mother of the hive is a parallel to the mother of the Lord. And therefore, these lead codices are a fascinating possible insight to the mindset of people, perhaps in the early Christian times, because although the writing is very old, the carbon dating says 1800 to 2000 years old, but it looks like it is an attempt to equate Christianity with the First Temple. Now, Deborah's story is very short. The story that really counts is the story of Yael, and Yael is Deborah's counterpart in the book of Judges. Because what happens is that Israel, or the Israelites, are in a battle with the Canaanites. It's been going on, it's a bit like the First World War with the trenches. You know, they were gaining 1 mile of ground and then losing a mile of ground and then gaining a mile of ground. And it was just going on forever and ever. And the people in the middle of this were having their lands destroyed, because the Israelites and the Canaanites were fighting across neutral land called Canaanite, the Canaanite lands. And the qualities of Gevurah are exactly what Yael shows in this story, because what happened was that Barak, who's the commander of the Israelite forces, goes to Deborah, the prophetess, and says to her, "We need your help to win this war. Can you help us?" And the first thing that is required of this man is humility, because Deborah says, "Yes, I will help you, but you must understand that victory will come to you by the hand of the female, of the feminine. It's not going to be from the battle, which is masculine, the going out and attacking people. It's going to come from the hand of the feminine." And Barak agrees, and he goes away, and they have a huge, great big fight, and the Israelites technically win the fight. But their commander, Sisera, escapes and runs away into the neutral lands. And he goes to the tent of Yael, the Canaanite. Can't remember what it means. I'm sorry, can't remember the word there. Kenite, that's right. Yael the Kenite. And she's neutral. He goes to her tent and invokes hospitality from her. She lets him in, she feeds him, and when he goes to sleep, she knocks a nail through his head. Straight like that. No questions, no arguments, nothing. And she ends that war. Now, this is the action of the samurai, which is perfect Gevurah, because Gevurah is martial arts and the samurai, which means that you do what needs to be done without anger or emotion. And there's a legend of the samurai where a samurai was sent to kill an enemy of his master. And he hunted down the man, caught him, and was about to kill him when the man spat in the samurai's eye. So the samurai got up and walked away, because if he had killed the man then, he would have killed him for anger. And that's not what a samurai did. So this is an execution to save her land. Now, I'm not saying physically we have to go out and stick nails in people's heads, because these are allegories. But these are the perfect indications of the power of a balanced gevura, the strength of mind to do this, the decision-making, the discernment. Can I do this? Is it going to be effective? The discipline of actually feeding him, waiting, saying nothing, giving nothing away, and the word no, which is this stops here now. And this structure, because she has to know where to hit with the nail. She has to know how to get it into his head. She has to have the structure of how to hit it with the mallet. And the law. Now, this is interesting. She broke the law of hospitality. And that's why the Jewish folk don't like this story very much, because she'd given him hospitality. And if somebody has hospitality from you, if they etch your salt, you are supposed to take care of them. But the law, L-O-R-E, means that the land and the creatures overrule human hospitality laws. And also Gevura is the place of death. She kills the man and she ends the war. That's it. It is over. It is done. There is no more debate. And the Israelites have won. Now, that's very nice for the Israelites, but she would have killed Barak if he'd been there. If the Canaanites were winning and Barak had run to her tent, Yael would have killed him, because her job was to end that war. So let's look at the allegories and how they're meant to work in our life. And the questions to ask ourselves are simple. Where are you putting your strength? Where are you putting your energy? Are you letting it diffuse? Are you telling your stories of woe rather than acting on them? Where is your sturdiness? And can you discern truth? Now, in this modern world, that's particularly difficult. Remember, Tiferet, the place of truth and beauty, which is the true self, is about understanding that a real truth, a perennial truth, has a beauty to it. It has a strange and powerful beauty. A truth that is all glamour or a truth that is hideous is a partial truth. It's a truth of projection. Very important, what is your spiritual discipline? What is your commitment to God and to the planet? And the two have to work together nowadays, because we as humanity are the only species that's been destroying or damaging this planet. And we have to understand that she is part of the Great Mother. She's part of the body of the Great Mother. So have you got the spiritual discipline to do something about this? And what do you do every day to keep yourself strong, to keep yourself discerning? Do you manage to detach from situations so you can observe with neutrality? That's a very difficult one, because we get very tied up with our emotions. And the side triads on the Tree of Life are all about emotions and addictions. And these, in our modern world, we're trained to go into these emotions and addictions. Marketing thrives on them. You know, you're not pretty enough. Get some Botox, buy some L'Oreal, do this, do that. Whereas if you can detach, you can look at it and say, well, actually, why is that advert there? They want to sell something, which means their primary goal here is to make money. Okay, we understand that. Do I want to give them money? Okay, if I want to give them money, do I believe that this is actually going to make me look younger? I'm not sure. Is it going to make me feel better? It is going to make me feel better, in which case I would like to buy it. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But going through that process is so valuable. Instead of, oh God, I'm starting to look my age, I need some rejuvenating cream. That's panic. That's addiction. That's not gevura. Probably most important, where do you need to say no? Because so often we don't, we cavil, we go maybe or perhaps or I'll see about it. But the word no is the absolute archetypical power of the divine feminine, and it's a gentle, strong no. Just no. Can you wait and pray and see before you act? This comes back to detaching from situations. So many stories in the Bible, and we'll be looking at this with the story of Esther next week, rely on the fact that you wait. You know what needs to be done, but you allow the time for the help that the divine is going to send you to manifest, because the divine can act in simultaneously, but it takes humanity a little bit longer to catch up. So can you wait, give it to God, and then see what happens? We're looking at the story of Hannah in a minute, and she embodies that. Is the structure of your life balanced? By which I mean, have you got some kind of nurturing routine to build your strength? Do you observe the law, L-O-R-E, which is the honourable harvest? We'll look at that again in the last section, but we've already dealt with it. And what in your life needs to be dispatched quickly, easily, and in peace? So I will leave you to contemplate those at another time, but they're very much worth holding to as a pattern to look at to see where it is that you may not be working with the divine feminine. So we're going to move on now to the story of Hannah. Hannah represents the soul, and Hannah is the story of letting go and letting God, which is so difficult for us. It really is. Hannah is the story of a woman before the building of the first temple here. And she was the mother of Samuel the prophet. And there's a beautiful modern version of her on the picture there. I don't suppose she looked like that at all, with the beautifully crimped hair. But the story of Hannah is told in the first book of Samuel. Her name means grace. And as she represents the soul triad in the tree of life, that is pierced by the triad above it, which goes from, on that picture, from Eve down to Ruth, up to Lilith, and up to the I Am. And that is part of the spiritual world of Berea. So the soul is pierced by spirit. And if our soul is working, then we receive grace. And if our soul is open, grace is always offered, as long as we allow ourselves the time and the discipline to sit and wait for it. So Hannah was the first wife of a man called Elkanah from the town of Ramah, which is supposed to be 4 or 5 miles from Jerusalem. And he had a second wife because Hannah was barren. And in those days, certainly Solomon was polygamous, and many of the patriarchs were, many people in those days were. You were allowed to divorce your wife if she was childless. But many men loved their wives, and if she was childless, would just take a second wife. And that was what happened with Elkanah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah was barren. And Midrash says that if a couple's been married for 10 years without having children, the husband is obliged to take another wife in order to fulfill the commandment to be fruitful and multiply. Midrash is the commentary on Torah and the Talmud, and some of it's very useful and some of it kind of shows the attitudes of the age. A different text, however, says that Hannah was the one who decided that Elkanah should marry Peninnah, but believing that if God saw she'd done right by her husband, he would remember her too. Anyway, Elkanah continued to love Hannah, but Peninnah was not a nice woman, and she made it entirely clear that the older woman was second to her. She was the lesser because of her childlessness, and she provoked and bullied Hannah. And Hannah wept and did not eat, 1 Samuel 1:7. So this is actually a strong parallel to the stories of Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel, who are in the matriarchs, and they asked their husbands to invoke on their behalf. And Sarah just simply didn't believe that she'd have a child because she was past menopause. But Rebecca asked Jacob to invoke on her behalf, and so did Rachel ask. Rebecca asked Isaac, and Rachel asked Jacob to invoke on her behalf. And eventually both of them did have children. However, Hannah doesn't do that. Hannah doesn't go to her husband to ask for his help, because Hannah, pre-Second Temple, is a woman who knows that she can go and ask the divine. She can go and ask the Great Mother. And she goes to visit the city of Shiloh, which was near Jerusalem. That was the temporary home of the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle before the first temple was built. So it was sort of like a movable temple. And I'm quite sure that it was surrounded by trees and offerings to the Asherata, even if they weren't inside that. But Hannah goes to the sacred place where the Ark is lodged, and that she wouldn't have been allowed to do in the Second Temple, because women weren't allowed that close to the Holy of Holies. And she was in great bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord of Hosts. And that's relevant. She doesn't pray to Yahweh alone. She prays to the Lord of Hosts. And hosts are the angels or the helpers of the Lord. And they were looked upon as adjuncts of the Lord, as just the way the spiritual folk now turn to angels. So this is an indication that there is not just one God, there are aspects to God. So it's another pointer to an earlier text. And she makes a vow that day. Hannah says, "O Lord of hosts, if you will look upon the affliction of your handmaid and remember me and not forget me, but will give me a man-child, I will give that child to you all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." Now, what she's doing is to offer her child as a Nazarite. A Nazarite was a holy man who didn't shave his head, he didn't cut his hair, and he didn't drink wine, and he never did all sorts of things that were ritually impure to other people. The Nazarites are described in the book of Numbers as, "He shall separate from wine and strong drink, shall drink no vinegar of wine, nor shall he drink any liquor of grapes." They're pretty... No, he can't have moist grapes either, or dried grapes, so grapes are definitely out. "All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that's made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husk. No razor shall come upon his head, and he shall be holy. He shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow. He shall touch no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father, his mother, his brother, or his sister when they die, because the consecration of his God is upon his head. All the days of his separation as a Nazarite, he's holy to the Lord." So he's to be kept ritually pure at all times. So you can think, well, that's a bit mean of Hannah. She's offering this child whether the child likes it or not. But actually, if you look at the allegory, what she's doing is saying, "Let me be a channel of your divine grace." And Hannah is so emotional about this that one of the priests at the temple, Eli, thinks she's drunk because she's beating her breast and tears pouring from her eyes, and he laughs at her. He believes that she is talking from the nephesh, which is the lower part of her, just overly emotional. But she's actually talking from her heart. The book says... Samuel says she spoke in her heart. And the word for heart or soul is nephesh, which is neshama, the higher level of the soul. So she's speaking at a higher will, and she's invoking the Lord. And what happens is, once she's put that prayer out, she lets go. She completely lets go, and she trusts, and she goes home. She doesn't weep, she doesn't cry, she doesn't worry about being bullied. She just says, "I've asked, therefore, if it's possible, it will happen." And that is the power of the soul. At that level, we say, "I've asked, if it's for my highest good, it or something better will happen." So Elkanah makes love to Hannah, and she gives birth to a son. She calls him Samuel. Samuel is Hebrew for "his name is El." So she is acknowledging that this is from the ultimate God, from beyond Yahweh. If his name is El, then Samuel's son would be Yahweh, because El and Ashrata were the parents of Yahweh. So that's significant. Samuel isn't a god, obviously, but he is the prophet who brings the first king of Israel and is the one who brings David, whose son Solomon becomes the builder of the first temple. So Hannah has a child. She keeps Samuel at home until about the age of 3 when he's weaned, then takes him to the tabernacle, and she meets Eli and tells him how her prayer's been answered, and from then onwards Samuel lives with the priests, and Hannah visits him every year with clothing, and he became a great prophet. And the lovely thing is that Hannah conceives 3 more sons and 2 daughters of her own. So having had her womb opened, she becomes fertile and becomes a happy mother. And she too has a song of praise, just like Deborah does, which is very interesting because these women are singing songs of the divine. And also, according to the Midrash, this is one of the good bits of the Midrash, she was merciful to Peninnah, who became barren and many of whose children died, because nothing like a bit of revenge from God there. I don't know if that happened. But the wonderful thing was Hannah was merciful and prayed that Peninnah might be spared her last 2 living children, and the Lord heard her prayer. So the story of Hannah is not actually about a woman and a baby. That's the physical story, but the allegory is about a project or a desire or a purpose. So what the Divine Feminine here tells us is, can you make a clear request? Gevura is very precise. Hannah goes and says, will you give me a son? She doesn't even say a child, she says a son, and I will bring him up as a Nazarite. And most of our problems when we pray is we're just too vague. Way too vague for the angels who carry our prayers, because they're not human and they can't read our thoughts. They just pick up the emotion that we're carrying and think, what on earth is that? Whereas if you just say, give me a son, then they'll take that prayer up and the answer will be yes or no. When we don't hear answers to prayers, it's because our prayers were too vague. Sometimes the answer to a prayer is no, because it would not be for our highest good. But a clear prayer will always get yes or no as an answer. So are you being clear when you ask for things? And where do you ask for help while you're not willing to surrender anything? Because this is the allegory and the metaphysics of the fact that Hannah is saying, give me a son and I will give him back to you. Because in theory, Hannah would want to hold that son to her breast forever. It would be so valuable, and it would be the heir of her husband because she's the first wife. But no, she's willing to give something precious to her up. And most of the time when we pray, we've got a little caveat going on, which is basically, God, I want your help, but don't mess with my relationship. God, I want your help, but don't mess with my prosperity. Don't mess with my home. Don't mess with my children. Don't mess with my pets. Don't mess with my work. And we've got this sort of condition that we put on our prayers. And I'll admit I do the same. I say to God, I am not willing to offer my life to you totally if you're going to take my husband. I've been widowed once and that's quite enough, thank you. So I'm going to ask you prayers, but I am going to put that caveat on. And sometimes that's okay, because if you're clear about the caveat, you can still have your prayer answered. But if you don't acknowledge the caveat, then that's part of the resistance that blocks the power of the prayer. So it's very worthwhile working out what is it you aren't going to allow God to mess with. And if you know what you won't allow God to mess with, it will help your prayer, because you and God will actually know what you're talking about and you'll be being honest. Also, do you ask for help and then immediately take back the problem? And I've seen this, and our local rector here down in the Widden Parishes in Devon said to me one of the first times we met, he sends me Christmas cards every year that says, another year of holy mischief. I love that man. He's gorgeous. And he says, you'll understand this. You'll have seen this too. I see people walk up to the altar in my church, pray, give their problem to God, stand up, dust their knees down, pick up the problem and walk out of the church again. Because they just cannot let go. They're still going to go on and on and on and on and on about the problem. Now, Hannah doesn't do that. And Gevurah is able to let things go. Let go and let God. I've asked, that's it. End. Now, most of us can't do that. But if we move a little bit more towards that, then we are honouring the divine feminine and we're becoming strong and powerful. So can you let go of let God? And finally, if you give your word, will you keep it? That's another caveat along the lines of what can't you mess with. Be aware that it's important not to give your word if you don't think you're going to keep it. Hannah kept her word. She had the child. She could have not taken him back to the temple, but she did. And because she kept her word, she was rewarded by further grace. God is not actually transactional. We always think that God is transactional, and the Yahweh teachings are very much about a transactional God. And modern day Christianity teaches about a transactional God. But any true prayer and relationship with the divine is transformational. When you ask for something, you are transformed so that you can receive it. So God will transform you so you can receive what you want, which is why you've got to put the caveats on, which says you can transform me up to this level. But if you've got the courage, absolutely, and I have just begun in my life to be able to say this, I've been able to say, dear God, how much I want to live to my old age with this husband whom I love so much, and having lost two husbands, it would be a blessing for me. Nevertheless, thy will be done. And Lan's got a life and a right to keep living too, so I think we'll be all right. But the power in it is to say, thy will be done. I am asking for this, but thy will be done. Next week, we're going to be looking at the story of Esther, who is the first known female Messiah. And if that sounds really weird to you, this is not Christian. In Jewish mysticism, there is always an anointed of God alive in the world, one human being who is at the level of being the transmitter of grace on the earth, one person. They're said to have 70 helpers or tzaddikim, wise humans, with them. And there are plenty of very wise humans helping the tzaddikim as well. And I would suggest that people like Martin Luther King might have been a tzaddik. People like Richard Rohr, one of my teachers, I'm quite sure that he's a tzaddik, a very wise man. I mean, I could be wrong, but to me, he's a tzaddik. But there's one person. And the story of Esther, who has her own book in the Bible, is the story of a Judaic mythical Messiah. Because in Judaism, in the Old Testament, the Messiah saves their physical people. The upgrade of a Messiah, as demonstrated by Jesus when he became the Christ, was a Messiah who didn't save his physical people, but worked with the souls of people. And he was seen as a failure as a Jewish Messiah because he didn't release Judea from the rule of the Romans. That's why he wasn't accepted back then. But the upgrading is an interesting concept of the idea of bringing us back to our own relationship to the divine so that we can release ourselves and don't actually need a Messiah. I've thrown in a sneaky advertisement on page 13 there because I've written a book called A Woman's Worth, which is the story of all the women in the Bible going up the tree of life and looking at all their stories in allegory and metaphysics and mysticism. And it's in far more detail than this webinar is. So if you fancy it, go and have a look. And your homework is going to be find a no and activate it. And you don't have to do this in the next week, obviously. But just consider this. What is there in your life that is a maybe, that is just sitting there, simmering away and not being sorted? Stuart Wilde wrote in his wonderful book, The Infinite Way, there is yes and there is no maybe. And I just thought that was breathtaking because I've always been a maybe kind of girl. And he said, if it's maybe, it's no. It may be no for today, it could be yes another day, but there is no maybe. It's either yes or it's no. And if you're saying no, maybe, what you're actually saying is no, not now. So that's worth remembering. Where are your maybes? And can you find a maybe that is blocking your path? A maybe that is one of these resistances to prayer, one of these resistances to grace and miracle coming into your life. So where is your no? And that's your webinar for the night. But if anybody has questions, please go right ahead and ask them, because I'm just sitting here and we've got 10 whole minutes. So unmute your microphones, please, and let me know if you've got any thoughts. I can wait.
I'm not sure if this is 100% appropriate, but we know how masculine-oriented the Freemasons are. But in one of the side orders of Masonry called the Scarlet Cord, there are several levels or degrees within the Scarlet Cord, but it's remarkable how feminine they are, because they bring in a lot of the tales of the women of the Bible in their ritual. And it's the only part of Masonry where the feminine is elevated to be the divine feminine. I find it fascinating.
That is fascinating. There is, Margaret Barker often says that the origins of Masonry were from the First Temple. And I know that you being a Mason, you've studied Kabbalah for a long time, and you've taken me into place Masonic lodges where we've seen the menorah and all these extraordinary parallels and concepts. And it's like everything else. The idea behind Masonry is beautiful. And the Masons were the people who built the great sacred cathedrals like Chartres, which are built on the Tree of Life, and St. Paul's Cathedral, which is built on the design of Jacob's Ladder, and King's College, Cambridge, which is also built on the Tree of Life, and Béziers Cathedral, and many, many other wonderful places. And
well, as my mother used to say, the only problem with Masonry are the Masons.
Oh, well, it's exactly the same. That the only trouble with politics is the politicians. Right. Yes. Yes,
and I might add that my mother was a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason.
Well, there you go then. But yes, many Masons now have absolutely no concept of how sacred Masonry was intended to be. And in many places, it's just a social club. But I remember going around the Great Grand Temple in London, and we had a guide who wasn't a Mason, but he was very knowledgeable. And he was telling us about all the images in the Great Hall, except the one of all the astrological signs, because he was saying, this is symbolic of that, and this is symbolic of that, that's just pretty, and this is symbolic of that, and this is symbolic of that, because he could not...
Don't look there.
He certainly couldn't see that might be any symbology in astrology. Anybody else?
There are a lot of us Masons around here.
Where's that?
Here.
Oh, here on the webinar. Yes. Yes. Genuine Masons. Yes, absolutely.